I always said I got into graphic design because I loved the taste, the smell, the feel of the material. It's all very sensual.
When it comes to graphic design, few practitioners bear the weight of experience and achievement like the Canadian Burton Kramer. The Ontario-based artist behind the CBC logo talks to us about the future of his craft and plumbs the depths of over six decades in the game. Today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also,
it's a very lovely opportunity to physically present something that has a bit of time. You know, to give your time to something is what we don't have much of that these days, so that really says a lot, really.
We're covering Christmas with our friends at Esme Winter, a UK-based design venture behind an alluring range of graphic stationery and reliable wrapping paper to boot. That's all ahead right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, in an industry that's too often ruled by trends, Burton Kramer made a name for himself early on in his career, back in the 1950s, as a man who was willing to take risks and go against the grain. Kramer was one of the first graphic designers in Canada to champion the use of Helvetica, and his designs, including that of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's brand identity and logo type, won him international acclaim and respect. And as Monocle's man in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, discovered, despite his 60-odd years in the industry and the advent of online technology, Kramer isn't one to look backwards for inspiration.
I think the thing about the Swiss design that I appreciated, which was not all Swiss design, the word that they used to describe it was streng. And it took me quite a while to figure out what that really meant. And what it meant was austere. And I like that a lot. I like the restraint, and I like the state of tension and compression, if you will, in the work, where moving anything a fraction of a millimeter would destroy it. It was all in a kind of, I don't know if balance is the right word, but it held together.
And what about that was alluring to you from a design sense?
I don't know, except that perhaps I came from an environment where excess was the rule, and I didn't like that very much.
Fast forwarding to maybe one of your most famous commissions, the design of the logo for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. How did those principles of restraint, but also capturing the huge reach of something like the CBC?
They needed a visual identity that would work in French and English and for Radio Canada International as well. It seemed to me it had to be a visually broadcasting symbol. And it had to express itself as being Canadian. I mean, that already leads you in the direction I went in, which resulted in a C for Canada broadcasting by expanding outward. And the form it took could be the world.
The scallops, I suppose, radiating out.
Yes.
What was the notion there for you when you were creating this idea of it?
It's like throwing a pebble into a pond and watching the plunk radiate outward.
Would you say when you are, you know, given a commission or when you won a commission, and the sort of the initial design phases or the storyboarding or the sketches, what was that process like? Was there a method to that for you, or are you more of a go with the emotion of a feeling and sketch it out and see how it goes?
I scribble on everything. If you get near me, you're likely to be scribbled on. And I've spent many hours sitting in a chair, I can't exactly say scribbling, but trying to figure out the form that something should take.
And how do you reconcile that with this notion, going back to the Swiss years, when you said that the precision, the austerity in many ways, how do you reconcile those things?
I think in Amadeus, his patron says to him, it has too many notes. And he argues back that it has just the right number of notes, neither too many nor too few. And I think that's the trick of arriving at a good logo design.
How difficult is it to create a logo that then has stories and that keeps sort of telling you things, but is a static object like the CBC logo was, but it had so much, it evoked a lot of life and a lot of movement in a way.
It has to connect with people and they have to grow to love it. If they like it immediately, they're probably going to be bored with it in 6 months or a year. But if they grow into it, then it becomes part of their environment.
And being a part of their environment, would you say that they're, given that you've had such an influence over lots of elements, I suppose, of a Canadian visual vocabulary, is there a visual vocabulary here? What were you sort of inspired by and how did you want to sort of dictate it?
Is there a Canadian visual vocabulary? I think I have said, I don't know how many times, that I'm interested in doing things which are good and the rest will take care of itself. I mean, it's automatically expressive of where you are because you're influenced by your surroundings. But to set out to make it be Canadian or American or Swiss is, I don't think, is in the cards unless you're working for a governmental agency or something of that sort.
What about being in Canada, for example, then? Do you think, looking back, maybe, what were the influences at play there, do you think?
I don't know if I can really answer that. I think you bring to whatever you're doing all your own background and experience and things that you know and things that you love, and you can't do more.
You've discussed a lot during your career, or it has been discussed about you, the notion of your philosophy for graphic design and the way you approached your work. When you say nothing's worth doing unless it's good, or you do it because of the quality of the thing in question that's at hand, how does then a sort of philosophy, from your point of view, emerge from that when you deal with things as they come, when looking at something sort of in the moment, I suppose, is the most important thing, rather than trying to eke out a sort of overarching theme or aesthetic?
Well, I should start out by saying that probably 96.6% of everything that's done is either terrible or mediocre. So that leaves a very small amount. And I'm only interested in doing things that wind up being in that small amount. I think it also, I mean, you've walked in here and sort of had a quick glance around and I think have been pleased at what you saw. But I rarely walk into anyone's place and I'm pleased unless they happen to be an architect or a designer and artists, of course, but they tend to be poor.
So do you think that being a slightly tough crowd, if it's fair to characterize it like that, is that an essential thing in being able to...
Well, if you're looking for quality and if you're looking for things which satisfy you or satisfy me, that's not so easy. I was in a class that Alexei Brodovich gave at night in New York, and he used to say to us, astonish me. Well, here's a man who's seen everything and done everything, and it would take quite a lot to astonish him.
And does it take quite a lot to astonish you, therefore, as well, would you say, Nat?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I hardly go to art galleries anymore because what's on the walls mostly makes me sick.
What about, say, a contemporary art gallery, broadly speaking? You know, is there something broader about the state of sort of craft or...
I think people have lost track of what art is about. I think they've confused entertainment with art. And so what's in those places is kind of arty entertainment or just entertainment. And I guess in my harsher moments, I've said things like, if I walked into a gallery and found rats nailed on the wall, I wouldn't be surprised. And I think that a lot of what's on the walls is there for shock value, and that's not interesting to me.
You're a painter now, as you say. Is there an overlap for you, and where is the overlap in terms of your career in design or graphic design and painting?
Well, I think Paul Rand said something like, art is design and design is art. And someone said, that was the difference between craft and art. And the explanation was, if you could pee in it, it was craft. If you could pee on it, it was art. I think design is generally an attempt to solve someone's problem, and art is only to solve your own problem. It's a chance to play God, to be the creator and not have to take any crap from anyone.
Which is quite a nice position to be in, I would imagine.
I mean, yes, of course. There's always the fact that if you're trying to sell it, so no one may buy it. And for most people here, I think what I do is pretty strange, pretty alien, because they don't see it anywhere. I mean, they're completely, what you see in the galleries is, and the local notion of art seems to be landscapes and flowers.
And how would you put into words what you paint?
What I paint is interactions of color, interactions of geometry and color. I suppose that's about it. Sometimes the mood that is evoked by the use of color and form is very positive, and I tend to try to make paintings that are positive rather than nasty negative, because I think we have enough horrible stuff around us and the world doesn't need more.
And was that feeling something that was at the core of your graphic design work too, would you say?
Probably, but not consciously. Back in the 50s, I was quite enthusiastic about abstract expressionism, and the wilder and more violent it was, the more I liked it. I don't like it anymore, I'm sorry to say.
What changed?
I suppose I got older, or I became more aware of all the violence going on constantly in the world, and thought, you have to fight against it.
And fight against it with an uplifting view rather than...
Yes, yes, absolutely, for sure.
Is the quality of sort of the design landscape now, at this stage of your career, graphic design, I guess, particularly, are there things that excite you that you see? Is the quality high?
Well, first of all, I'm not really paying a lot of attention to what's going on in design, in graphic design. It's not where my interest is. It's not what I'm doing. And so I don't, you know, I get occasional magazines, which I didn't ask for, but they send them to me. And there's not much in there that's exciting to me. And a lot of it seems retro, not retro to mid-century graphic design, but retro, even going back further than that.
is looking back a kind of pointless task then, do you think? Should we be creating new things, creating the new?
Vignelli talked about doing design that would be timeless, and then he said one day while shaving it occurred to him that timelessness was just another fad. I think that's probably true, and I think that in North America, things have very short shelf life. People have very short interest spans. And the thing I always admired about Swiss design was that they took something and they refined it and polished it and refined it until it was super perfect. And most people don't bother.
And in your artwork now, would you say that you're a refiner and a polisher?
Absolutely, for sure, yes. Yeah, and it's not easy. Starting a new painting is a bit like jumping into water over your head. It's sink or swim.
Do you find yourself sinking more often than you swim?
Well, I mean, you have to know how I work, and that is that I figure that the whole painting out before I ever paint it. I used to do it with cut paper, kind of collaging what I was doing, and then I learned how to draw these things in Illustrator on the computer, and then after a time I stopped making the collages and do it all on the computer, so I can change everything and anything at any time, and I do, until I have it where I'm happy with it, and then I enlarge it and paint it. It's people have said, well, once you've got it figured out, why do you need to paint it? And I think the answer is because what's on the computer is not paint, and it's not on canvas, and it's not on a panel, and it has no, even if a very fine texture, it's not there.
So the physical act is still absolutely key to the artistic process.
Well, I always said I got into graphic design because I loved the taste, the smell, the feel of the material. It was all very sensual. The last time I taught, I was in a room with more than 40 students all hidden behind computer monitors. You know, there's no rubber cement, there's no scissors, knives, colored paper, things you've picked up on the street or in a five and dime. It's a shame. They have lost a lot. And of course, I was one of the people who, I mean, when I was at school in Chicago, I hand set and printed and illustrated a little book of Lorca's Lament for the Death of a Bullfighter. When I was at Yale, I printed a play in French that was written by one of the faculty and set some of the type for it and made the plates for the cover and printed the biggest edition of the biggest book that anyone in my class did. And I just liked doing that.
Just a sort of final thought. This notion of sort of, you know, making things and having tangible things that you sort of use as part of that creative process, what effect does, say, sitting behind a computer screen, in your view, sort of have on the artistic motivated?
Absolutely. I don't really see how people can go very far that way without having something more touchy-feely to rely on. I was giving a talk in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Lou Dorfman, who had been head of design at CBS, was there, and he said, I'm going to tell them to smash their computers, to which I said, lots of luck.
Graphic designer Burton Kramer there, speaking to Monocle's one and only Tomos Lewis in Toronto. Now, here on Section D, we are evangelists of inner city living. And there is a received wisdom that suggests people living in higher density areas consume less energy and share more resources. However, two researchers from the College of Architecture at Chicago's Illinois Institute of Technology, the clever souls behind it, focused on 250 dwellings in both high-rise and low-rise suburban areas. Contrary to popular beliefs, their study showed something rather counterintuitive, that people living in high-density areas in our cities were actually using more energy than their suburban brethren. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Rylan. He's at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Founded in 2011, Esme Winter is a UK-based firm that makes all manner of beautiful ephemera, from letterpress cards to winsome notebooks, postcards, and plenty of finely printed beauties besides, not to mention some of the most fetching wrapping paper you're likely to lay your hands on. And as tis the season, Ben Rylan invited founders Richard Sanderson and Esme Winter herself out of the cold and into Midori House to ask their advice for cladding presents in paper this Christmas.
Would you like it gift wrapped?
Yes, right.
Lovely. Let me just pop it in the box. There.
Look, could we be quite quick?
Certainly, sir. Ready in the flashiest of flashes.
Watching a professional gift wrapper at work can be an exhausting experience. All that folding and taping and ribbon twisting. You might be asking yourself, why bother? Anyway, it'll all be ripped apart in a matter of seconds.
For me, from a personal point of view, I think it really brings a sense of occasion to whatever the special moment is or for the person. And I think it really adds a sense of value.
Well, if you ever find yourself attending a dinner party at the home of Esme Winter and Richard Sanderson, here's a tip. Avoid the temptation to bring along a gift left inside a tatty old shopping bag.
I just think it's a very lovely opportunity to physically present something that has a bit of time. You know, to give your time to something is what we don't have much of that these days, so that really says a lot, really.
Happy holidays! Happy holidays!
Since 2011, the brand, known simply as Esme Winter, has been rustling up some of the most delicately detailed paper products. And even if you're partial to the instant satisfaction offered by a gift bag, you may find the gentle allure of Esme Winter's wrapping paper hard to resist. So, ribbons and bows aside for the moment, is there more to a perfectly presented present than mere cosmetics?
We feel that it's kind of a reflection on the person who's giving the gift as well. You want to feel like this is something I put in an effort for you and this is something for you to enjoy.
Those sort of gifts could be coming from a memory that you have shared together. You may have picked up something, or it might be something you haven't even bought. It's just something that was found to sort of log that memory. And it's you're sort of one-on-one, the folding and the creasing of the paper and putting a bit of personality into it.
To show you've made effort, I think, is a big thing.
Yeah.
To show you've put time in. I mean, that's almost as important as the gift itself.
Almost finished.
Almost finished? What else can that be? You're going to dip it in yoghurt? Cover it with chocolate buttons?
Who knows? We're going to pop it in the Christmas box.
But I don't want a Christmas box.
For some people, staring down a stack of unwrapped Christmas presents may bring about a sense of anxiety not experienced since a schooltime art class. Not everyone can take a roll of paper and a wheel of tape and create something worthy of submission to a museum. But, as Richard and Esme explain, there are a few tips that anyone can follow to put us back in touch with the traditional art of gift wrapping as it was intended.
First and foremost, just setting aside that time to do it. I don't think it has to be perfect. I think you can throw, you know, all your personality into it. If it's a piece of newspaper that's scrumpled up, but it's got an amazing, you know, ribbon that's cinching in all the sides, so it's a little bit crumply. But I just think anything goes, really, as long as you've just put that time in. If you are using paper, I would say the first thing is to be confident in cutting the paper. So whatever shape or size a gift is, you don't want too much paper because it really makes the folding a lot more difficult. And then you have a huge sort of bulk that you're trying to tape down and it just won't work. So just be confident and try and cut with a nice margin around the edge. If you don't want to use paper, lots of people use really beautiful envelopes. You can reuse cardboard boxes. We also sell some beautiful boxes, which people do use for gifts, and then they become an even further gift, which you reuse in the home, in the office.
It's personal. Yeah. It's the thing. It's between you and the person you're giving the gift to,
yeah,
and sparking a memory or a little bit of, like Esme says, it's a bit of joy from seeing the object.
When I was growing up, my mother always had this very specific idea of what she wanted her Christmas tree to look like. There was always this very strict no tinsel rule, and that extended to the wrapping of the presents too. There was this sense of neat uniformality to the point where I think one year she quite controversially had all the gifts wrapped in brown paper with only string, no ribbons. It seems like such a modern idea now, but thinking back, of course, that had such an influence on me because it had me questioning from a very early age how things look and appear and, well, I suppose, why we care about such things and why the appearance of something can really make us feel a certain way.
That's really nice that you've said about your memories of from your mum. And I think every family definitely has those memories. And for us, for me certainly, that's how the business started, based on memories and this heartfelt sort of sentimental values that were instilled. With all of the decorations sort of popping up in the shops and the streets, I think people do feel a little bit more brave. We're actually using a lot of dried flowers. So for our special online customers, we're sort of wrapping things in tissue paper and using our paper. And then we may choose a colour of a ribbon, and that will be the theme for this year. And along with that theme, we are using these dried flowers that have been taken from, you know, the garden or all around. It's just that really personal touch. And I think just also being in touch with the environment around you.
For anyone who's buying gifts, they often will wrap them in similar papers and things like that. And so you've got your own little curation. I certainly enjoy doing that.
Yeah.
Matching colours and things like together. But then at the same time, under the tree, you're getting gifts coming from all different people, so we haven't spoken to each other about what those papers might be. So it is always naturally a bit of a clash, and that's part of the fun, really.
Also, I just get so excited by paper and different textures. And my father was a book auctioneer, so growing up in that world of books and seeing all the beautiful end papers and the marbled papers, and I think that's, you know, absolutely sort of coming through. And just, yeah, it's, for me, it's kind of a treasure trove and a bit like a magpie with paper. Happy
holidays! Various studies have found that when it comes to the satisfaction a gift might offer, most people aren't all that excited by usefulness. Often, it's the frivolous pleasure of receiving that leaves us with a lasting impression, especially when the gift is thoughtfully chosen and elegantly presented. So whether you choose to cloak your presence in the fine, handcrafted paper treasures of Esme Winter, or you find yourself reaching for a stack of old newspapers in the final few days before Christmas, don't be afraid to loosen the rules a little and make it personal.
It's the holiday season. Richard Sanderson and Esme Winter there, of the latter's eponymous stationery firm, speaking to this show's producer, Ben Rylan. Next week, you lucky things, it's our Christmas special. We'll hear from some of the favourite voices of 2017, including an exhibition honing in on the art rather than the architecture of the late Zaha Hadid, and a word from Santiago Calatrava. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Daphne Karnesis, and edited by George McDonough. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.